Hello, my name's Tom Walker. Welcome to That'll Be the Day. In this podcast, I'm going to be talking to a visually impaired thespian who's making his name as a director, actor, and enhanced facilitator. But before we hear from Anthony Goff, if you like the music at the start of this podcast, it's a track called That'll Be the Day by the Liverpool band The Vow. And as always, I'll be featuring a track by the band at the end of this podcast to find out which one I've chosen. Stay tuned.
Yeah, that'll be.
Now, Anthony's with me. We're in the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool. It's an iconic venue, isn't it, Anthony?
Oh, it is. It is. And I started working here. My first job here was right off the back of university on a show called Unsung, which was about the Liverpool abolitionist Edward Rushton.
And you know your way around this theatre, very obviously. Despite being visually impaired, that's no issue to you.
Yeah, yeah. It's taken time, but I've definitely got used to learning the routes around the building. Yeah.
Now, I have to say that it's very good of you to come over from Manchester because we're recording on a day where the weather isn't exactly great. I hope the journey was okay.
Yeah, we've been very careful travelling down here, and I've had to be careful with my feet not to slip over in the ice.
And it is early January, so we're thinking about the new year and what's coming ahead. What's coming ahead for you, Anthony?
So I've been working with Extant, doing on their post-enhance programme, doing some post-enhance facilitation. It's a programme I'll speak to you in more detail about that later on. But yeah, I've been working on that. I've also got a few commissions coming up and running a few workshops for youth groups and young people this year. And also hopefully continuing my work with Grey Eye Theatre Company as well.
You're a freelancer, so you're always available for bookings.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to be available, probably more available this year. So yeah, definitely free for bookings, whether it's access consultancy, audio description consultancy, workshop facilitation, directing, and obviously my acting work as well.
Let's go back to the beginning. How did you get involved in this crazy business?
Oh, gosh. So I'd have to go right back to school, really. Like a lot of people, I was bullied in school. And theatre, for me, was an escape. I didn't have to be the only person in class with a disability, the only person in class who was visually impaired. And I could explore different characters. And I really got into drama and theatre. And I just loved it. I got a bug for the stage when I was really young, when I was about 6 or 7. I remember one of my first school plays. I remember playing a bumblebee, being a very enthusiastic bumblebee, actually. And it's just grown from there. I went to an arts college called Edgerton Park. It's now closed, but it was specialised in performing arts. And, yeah, I just loved it.
Did the teachers recognise your talent?
Certainly one of them did, yeah, definitely, and she was brilliant. I always found in school, performing arts and drama and theatre is a class you either take seriously or you don't, and there was definitely a lot of people that didn't really take it as seriously as what I did, but I just loved it. I really did. Made so many friends.
You mentioned there you were bullied. Was that on the grounds that you're visually impaired, basically?
At the time, previously I went to a school called Shawgrove in West Didsbury for about 5.5 years. And when my parents divorced and we moved out of the catchment area, I had one final term at that school, and then we had to move to a different school. So I went from what was at the time called a special school into a mainstream school, and that transition was just a culture shock. I went from being surrounded by people who understood what it was like being visually impaired, what work needed to be done to help support me in my education, to having very limited support and being surrounded by a lot of people that just didn't get it because, you know, I mean, especially at that age, they probably didn't know somebody else who was visually impaired. So, yeah, that led to bullying. It wasn't it wasn't the best time.
So what were the challenges for you as a visually impaired person trying to make your way into the theatre, particularly as a young person?
I'd say finding the opportunities that were there for people who were visually impaired. At the time, there weren't many people you could turn to. I didn't really know at the time of any visually impaired actors or directors, for instance. And I think there's something in seeing people like yourself in those roles. And if you don't, or if there's a lack of you seeing other people like yourself in those roles, then you actually question, is this possible? Is this for me?
You often hear people saying, if you can't see it, you can't be it.
Exactly. That is exactly the case. And that's why in my work now, I'm passionate about being as open as possible and as loud as possible, because you have to be as loud as possible to be heard, to be seen, to be listened to.
Were you always loud as a young person? Because I don't know about you, but I was very self-conscious in my teens.
Certainly not. No, I was very quiet. I did not use a cane until I was 18. And even then, it was, even though I needed to, it was very intermittent. And I just couldn't do it because I didn't want to be seen as being different.
I think we followed very similar journeys, and we've got probably similar levels of sight, I imagine, just having walked with you.
Yeah. So without trying to get too medical, I've got a condition called congenital stationary night blindness. And so it's a form of night blindness. And what I find, one of my consultants said, in terms of describing it, it's like looking through a frosted glass window with blinkers on that a horse would wear. And that's very similar to my vision.
Well, it hasn't proved to be any barrier to you, as I hope it hasn't been to me in the work that I've done. And I think, but we do have to fight, don't we?
Definitely. I mean, at the time, even when I was 13, I remember an incident. I mean, it was in a medical environment, but it was very medical model. One of my consultants literally listed to a 13-year-old all of the jobs I wouldn't be able to do. And when he went through that list, he ended it by saying, well, what is it you want to do? And I said, well, I want to be an actor. And he said, well, you can do that. And so I was like, oh, well, thank you for your permission for being an actor. But yeah.
It's just weird, isn't it, in the way that able-bodied people think that they can tell us what we can and can't do.
Exactly. And 9 times out of 10, it's the environment and it's the social setting that sets up those barriers in the first place. A pet peeve of mine at the moment, just to example that, is when you actually go into bathrooms and everything's automated. So you're waving your hands around to try and find where the tap is and how the tap works. And you have to tap a sensor and finding where that sensor is. And you're waving your arms around everywhere. So, yes, it's making things more modern. Yes, it's making things more, I suppose, almost space age, but it's certainly not accessible.
I'm smiling, Anthony, because I'm thinking of Liverpool Central train station and the loos there, and I tell you, getting the taps to work is almost impossible.
Yeah, I take anti-bat wipes with me now just to be on the safe side.
So you went on to university. What did you study and what was that like?
So I went on to university. I studied performing arts at the University of Bolton. With some brilliant tutors, Dave and Nicola and Brid, and I got to work and shadow David Facker whilst he was the artistic director of
the Octagon.
And it was amazing. I met a very close friend of mine, Ali, there, who also just happened to be blind. And it was a bit like fate, actually, because, I mean, what were the chances of me going to the university that was attached to a theatre that in that year was working alongside a blind assistant director? It was just...
What did you learn from Ali?
I learned so much. She's so intelligent, really is. She's got an amazing brain. From Ali, I learned so much. I mean, I don't even know whether I'd be able to fit it into this podcast, but just to be open, to be true, and to listen to whether a character is being true to themselves, because you can hear that. You can hear whether an actor is really getting to the crux of a character. And you can hear it in their voice, you can hear it in the intonation in the voice. And so, yeah.
Do you think we're at an advantage as visually impaired people in that respect? Because our primary source of information, or at least for me, at least, is our hearing.
Definitely. But I do caution, I add a bit of a caveat to that, in that, yes, we do tend to use our hearing a lot, but that doesn't make us...
We can't hear more, can exactly. we? We just use it more.
Exactly. We're not superheroes. A lot of people tend to think that visually impaired people have supersonic hearing. We don't. We just have been able to fine-tune that hearing.
We've developed the sense, but we can't hear more.
Exactly.
So what was it like at Bolton? Did you get the help you needed, the support you needed as a visually impaired person?
It was brilliant, actually. So I obviously got a grant through Disabled Students Allowance, and that paid for a support worker, travel to the theatre as well. And it was brilliant. It was a brilliant time. I was really lucky with where I went.
Did you star in any shows during those 3 or 4 years in Bolton?
Oh, we starred in a few shows. We did quite a lot of street theatre, a lot of devised work. I remember portraying one of the seven deadly sins in one of the productions we devised. I also remember travelling around the student learning zone area dressed up in what can only be described as a bin bag. But drama students will do crazy things.
Sounds like you were pretty uninhibited.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to do theatre, jump in with both feet. That's what I say.
So you leave Bolton. Where'd you go to next?
So that's where I came to the Ev, actually. Literally within weeks.
And when you say the Ev, you mean the Everyman. We in Liverpool call it the Ev as well.
Yeah. So the Everyman Theatre. And within weeks of completing my course and graduating, I got in a tutor of mine got in touch, said, I'm writing a play with a co-write. And would you like to be involved? We'd like you to come on board as a shadowing director. And I was a shadowing director on a play called Unsung here at the Everyman for about 6 or 7 weeks. And that was a co-production with Dada.
I guess once you've graduated, things get a little bit more real, don't they? I found when I did my postgrad radio journalism, it was nothing like doing the real thing.
Exactly, and it is scary because you do, all of a sudden, it is down to you whether or not it's you going looking for the work in terms of doing auditions, in terms of are you creating the work, curating that work, generating that work, and so yeah, it's a big leap. I was just very lucky in that I had a lot of friends, I had a lot of people around me. And a great support network.
Directing is inevitably quite visual. You've got to know where people are on the stage. We don't have that available to us. So how do you do it? What are the adjustments you make to the process?
So I'm good at mapping the stage in terms of sound, like we mentioned earlier. I like walking around the stage to almost as if I was the I was an actor on stage. Myself, just to get a feel for the stage, what my actors are experiencing at that point. I also, in terms of the team around me, need to have complete trust in them as well. So whether that's working with a choreographer, whether it's working with a sound designer, and also I also utilise access to work, so I'll have a support worker with me who effectively, when I can't see or if there's detail that I'm missing, they then step in and give me some of that detail. When I was an actor actually performing last year in a show called A Greasy Spoon, during the rehearsal process, I had quite a few access workers. I've got almost a cohort of them now. I think there's about 17, 18 that I just call on and they work in kind of like a rotation or wherever they're available. But the audio description that I was getting from some of them, because what you've got to know about Greasy Spoon was it was a comedic farce, and it was quite blue. There was some quite blue moments in there, and it had foul language. And so you can imagine some of the things that the actors were doing and some of the things that my access workers had to audio describe.
I imagine for them it might have been a bit embarrassing for about 5 minutes.
Well, for about 5 minutes, but the majority of them were Scousers. And so actually some of them relished in the fact that they could actually audio describe some of these quite, shall we say, raunchy scenes.
And the good thing about Scousers is that they are so open, but at the same time very funny.
Very funny, very funny.
And not all of them, I hasten to add, but most of them.
No, exactly. And I've got a lot of family members that are from Liverpool as well, so my grandmother on my mother's side was born in West Derby. So,
you've done some acting as well. Just tell us a little bit about some of the performances you've been in.
So, yeah, I've done a bit of acting, following on from university, did a wee bit of Shakespeare. We then set up my own theatre company, and with that theatre company I've done a bit of acting as well. Again, in Shakespeare, we did a murder mystery that was brilliant. And again, I think how you think about theatre as a visually impaired person gives you a certain degree of, I suppose, enhanced creativity, in that you are thinking about theatre in a way that a lot of people aren't thinking about theatre. When I think about theatre, I think about from the very off, is what I'm doing accessible? Is what I'm doing accessible to a visually impaired audience?
And how do you make it accessible?
Oh, there's plenty of ways. Integrated audio description. Whether it's integrated AD, whether it's kind of creative captioning, trying to integrate BSL on stage is something I've been working on, especially working with Grey Eye and Jenny Seeley.
Just for the listeners' benefit, just in case you notice a change in atmosphere, Anthony and I have now moved rooms because the room we were in was booked by somebody else at midday, so we're now in a smaller room, which is a bit more echoey. Just going back to our conversation then, Anthony, you mentioned there about integrating accessibility, and I said that's part of the process.
Yeah, definitely. And if you can think about that, even from the start, so when you're developing a script as a writer, or if you're devising work, thinking about the visual information that you're giving on stage and how that is, how you follow through with that. So how you present that on stage, and there's so many different creative ways you can do that, whether it's through a narrator, whether it's whether you try and use technology and you use a speaker, whether it's something that's pre-recorded. There's so many ways to be creative with audio description.
I've spoken to quite a few visually impaired performers, most recently Mandy Redvers-Rowe. And Mandy, among others, has ways of orientating her way around the stage. Do you have any adaptations that you make?
Yeah, so beyond kind of markings that we use on the stage, which can sometimes be accessible, can sometimes not be, depending on the stage and the set, I use what I like to call anchors. And that's certain props, certain bits of furniture on stage to help me navigate the stage. And that's how I navigated the stage during a show called A Greasy Spoon, which was presented last year at the Royal Court Theatre in Liverpool.
And one of the issues as well for us as visually impaired people is we can't see the audience and whether we're getting any reaction from them. Does that bother you? Does that affect you in any way?
I think, again, it depends on what you're presenting. If you feel like whatever it is you're presenting needs a reaction, or if that's the aim, to gain a reaction. So if it's comedy, for example, are the audience laughing? Well, you can hear that. I mean, I can tell you one thing about some of the audiences at the Royal Court Theatre is they definitely interact with what's going on stage.
Do you like interaction generally?
I do, actually. I do. It doesn't really put me off, actually. A lot of actors say, oh, I don't like it because it puts me off or it takes me out of character. But actually, I think it challenges you. One of the things I do when I'm learning lines, for example, for the first time, is I'll go through lines in my head and I'll try and do two or three different activities in rotation. So it could be, imagine if you're preparing breakfast or you're waking up in the morning, and so three activities could be putting the toast in, brushing the teeth, combing your hair. Putting the toast in, brushing your teeth, combing your hair. And you think about that in a process and you keep doing that whilst learning your lines, you're automatically setting your brain to expect some of those things that would probably distract you and take you away from what you're trying to present as an actor.
You mentioned their learning of lines, and that to me would be an absolute nightmare because I've got a memory like a sieve. How do you go about learning your lines, and what format do you get them in? Is it accessible?
So the format used to really matter, because I used to have it in large print. More recently, what I've been doing is using what's called a line feeder. And that is literally a person who will read out the lines in a